Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am your host, Sadia Khan, and I'm really excited to share a special episode from the Homegoings podcast. A little while back, I had an amazing chat with Myra Flynn. Our episode is called Unboxed. She is the host of Homegoings, and we dove deep into the incredible work she's doing around race, identity, and the power of storytelling. I was doing some prep work for her interview, and I binge listened to Homegoings, all the episodes, and I kid you not, I was blown away. And I thought, why not share one episode with our listeners? So today I'm doing just that. In this episode, Myra kicks off her series, Stereo Antitypes, where she tackles some of the most harmful stereotypes Black men face, starting with the myths of the deadbeat dad. She's joined by Bendarvis Harshaw and Marlon Fisher, two men who've defied that narrative in their own powerful ways. Their stories are raw and honest, reminding us to look closely at what lies beneath the surface. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one, and come back next week for Immigrantly's new episode. Take care and enjoy.
Maybe you've heard this one before. Black women are angry. No? Okay. What about Black men are dangerous? Black people are lazy? We're violent? I bet you have. Chances are, if you haven't heard some of these sayings on this list, you're either living under a rock, and maybe that rock isn't in America, where most of these typecast ideas about Black people were born, or perhaps you're too busy surviving one of these labels individually to recognize that what you're battling is part of a list, a long list of popular, pervasive, and harmful stereotypes about Black people that have been around for a long, long time. They're so ingrained, in fact, they're nearly common knowledge at this point, part of our language, part of our jokes. So deep in our bones, we don't even have to name them as stereotypes to know they're there. We all eat watermelon. We love fried chicken. Black women are welfare queens. All Black people are poor. And this one.
All Black fathers leave.
This is my colleague at Vermont Public, Bryant Denton, my Black colleague. I say this because there's only 11 self-reported BIPOC people working at the station, so for us to get to work on something together is rare and beautiful, maybe even a little healing. Hi, Bryant.
Hi, Myra. Wait, we start over.
It's okay. Hi, Bryant.
Hello. Hi. What did you want me to say?
It's okay. I'll prompt you.
Oh, okay. 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 Make it harder. Don't know how to be greeted. Hello,
Hi,
Myra.
Bryant. Thinking about this last stereotype, that all Black fathers leave their kids, got me thinking a lot about Bryant and what he shared with me about his own upbringing.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, my family system is part of the stereotype. My dad left in probably maybe one of the worst ways. My mother became disabled. My mother has epilepsy that wasn't always a part of her life. And she got in a car accident. She had a seizure while she was driving, sustained a traumatic brain injury. And then my parents divorced after that. So talk about a time to leave. It was not great. You know, I don't have a lot of memories about life with my father, to be honest. It almost feels like when my life started when my dad left.
Bryant says he hasn't been in touch with his dad at all since he left in the early 2000s. He hasn't reached out to find him, and the only update he's had about him came by way of a mugshot online. Brian's father is a shadow, distant and in the past, and Brian likes it this way. He doesn't want to want anyone who doesn't want him.
There's just more things to think about in my life. There's better spent efforts. So if I was to receive a message from him and he wanted to connect, I suppose I would be open to that. But I'm not Googling him to find out if he's been arrested again.
Stereotypes are stereotypes for a reason. That's a stereotypical thing people I tend to stereotype say about stereotypes. Why not just say stereotypes suck? They're typically based on assumptions rather than information. They're usually pretty negative, stunting, and can be self-fulfilling prophecies in a way. If all you ever learn about people like you is what everyone else is saying about people like you, you're more than likely to become people like you instead of having a fair shot at being, you know, you. I wish that would catch on, that whole phrase, but it's a little long, and until that day comes that people treat people like people all the time, I have to say, stereotypes kind of fascinate me. I do agree that they are here for a reason, but that reason might not be what you think. A quick moment for science, if you will. Another couple words for stereotypes are implicit bias. Bias, as we know, is a form of prejudice or favor for or against, in this case, someone. But the implicit part is important here because implicit bias implies implicitly that we are not conscious of our biases. And studies tell us that this is something our brain does on purpose. It's a mechanism, a defense mechanism for processing, because we need to categorize all the billions of bits of information our brain receives each day unconsciously, or else we will become overwhelmed. So, while biased behavior like stereotyping can be harmful, so much so that it can even get some people killed, our brain at least believes that it's helping us determine what's safe and what's unsafe. I think the thing that makes me so curious is that our brains aren't dumb. They're brains. So by this logic, in the grand sussing out of the binary right and wrong, safe and unsafe, Republican versus Democrat, black versus white, etc., by this logic, stereotypes, if they're useful, should in large be true. Or close to it. So okay, sure, let's roll with that. Let's say it's true. All black dads leave. I mean, as Bryant knows, sometimes it is.
There isn't this sort of, you know, I'm not, oh, when is dad coming back? It's that's done. That's done, which I came to early in life. Unfortunate, but that's the truth.
Yeah, and then it all just makes me wonder about anti-types. The ones who buck the system, who make it past the implicit in the bias. In this case, the dads who stayed. From Vermont Public, this is Homegoings. I'm Myra Flynn, and today is part one of a four-part series we're calling Stereo Antitypes. And to be transparent, this series features all men. This wasn't on purpose, this was just where my reporting led me. A lot of these most troubling, most profound, most dangerous stereotypes apply to black men. Shocking, I know. So for the better part of 2024, I've been chatting with four black men about the stereotypes that have been applied to them their whole lives. We'll cover stereotypes like black people are stupid.
I applied for promotions often.
Black men are a threat to society.
Committed a robbery, and I was the mastermind behind it.
Black men all have huge...
The person was like, oh, I knew it would be big. And I was like, why? Like, what makes you say that?
And today's stereotype.
All black fathers leave.
All of these men have stories of bucking these stereotypes, hence the anti, but as it tends to be here on Homegoings, each journey is pretty darn nuanced. So, settle in. Today, my colleague Bryant Denton and I are getting right up in the ugliness of that intersectionality where implicit bias meets accountability, meets race, meets fatherhood. This is Homegoings. We're a proud member of the NPR network. Welcome home. You know, one of the main stereotypes that stood out to me when I was pulsing folks for a lot of the stereotypes people think about when it comes to brown and black people is this huge stereotype that's out there about the absentee black dad.
That's something that I've dealt with. Black families can be dysfunctional, that they can be, you know, they're not a good example of a family.
A recent stat I read actually said that black children are more than twice as likely to grow up without their fathers than white children. So that's a heavy stat. And it's just got me thinking, what's behind this? You know, if black dads are leaving, what's that about?
That's where it gets complicated for me.
Like, are we all under the assumption that they just left just because, or, you know, has something forced this stat into existence? And the same question on the other side, if they stayed, like, what's that about? And how did they manage to overcome some of these stereotypes? What did they have to face?
So tell me about life, kid.
So, life is so hard. And this guy's a chicken nugget. She looks like a butt cheek. She doesn't know what 4 plus 4 is. I would like to take you there right now.
Don't drop that.
Okay.
Sky's my name is Pendarvis. Pen for short. I am a journalist, educator, father, homie.
Bruh, you are stupid. It goes 64.
In case you're wondering about the cuteness in the background, that's Pendarvis's daughter, Zuri. I met Penn via a colleague of a colleague in public media. At the time, he was the executive producer and host of a podcast on KQED called Right Now-ish.
Hey, what's up with it? Excuse me, forgot. This is NPR. Hello, how are you doing today? My name is Pendarvis. My name is Penn for short. I'm the host of Right Now-ish from KQED, which is a podcast about arts and culture in the Bay Area.
R.I.P. to that show. It has since been sunsetted, and I, for one, consider that a travesty, Penn. Anyway, this show's description does accurately represent what the show is all about.
It's about history, it's about the future, and most importantly, it's about right now.
But the secret sauce to all of it is Penn himself and where he's doing this, in the Bay Area of California. Penn is completely obsessed with it. In fact, you can call him Mr. Oakland.
You have like a inherent like FOMO for Oakland. Like,
yeah, I do. Like... I do, man. I've been outside since I was like 10. Come on, man. Like, this is what I know, right? Like, I bike around. Yeah, exactly.
Like Penn says, he's been out in these colorful, hip-hop laden, murals everywhere, beautiful, super black Oakland streets since he was 10. And by out, I mean out, attending every concert, most barbecues and block parties, involved in the culture, the food, the community, moving from one rad person or place or event to the next, just eating life voraciously with both hands. But in early 2016, Penn's independent rhythm changed pretty drastically.
I was told that my daughter was on the way via a we need to talk text message and the phone call thereafter.
This text came from Penn's ex, an ex text, if you will, which, you know, is always complicated. But the fact that they were no longer together added an extra layer to the complication of it all.
The day before, maybe a day or two before, her mother, like,
walked back to my house and like dropped my bicycle off in front of my house, like, you know, kind of like symbolizing it's over. Like, don't leave your bike in my house no more. And yeah, it was, you know, it kind of shook my world. I wasn't ready. I wasn't prepared. I was halfway employed, halfway living at a homeboy's house, recent college grad, master's degree, you know, but I wasn't living up to my potential at the time. And yeah, I took it pretty hard, and it didn't bode well for like laying the foundation for a healthy relationship with her mother.
Look, I'm a parent in a marriage with a Black man who has stayed and is supportive. In real talk, still with that setup, some of these days are incredibly hard. So I can't imagine how it must have been for Penn and his ex-partner to be staring down the metaphorical barrel at the reality of what felt like their failed relationship and a huge first-time responsibility. For Penn, it did make him think about leaving. And not the kind of leaving you might think. The big leaving.
I think that what went through my mind at that time period was like a loss of feeling of power, where, you know, the decision wasn't mine anymore. My life isn't mine anymore. All of my freedom is gone, and you know, my life is over. And I actually became pretty suicidal at that time. It got really dark.
Like Penn says, he felt powerless at the time, stripped of any choice in the matter. There was also this internal disappointment because he could nearly hear the whispers of his ancestors saying, "Psst, Penn, we've been here before."
I felt myself being enslaved to a cycle of poverty. I hadn't gotten out of the predicament that I was raised in, and I didn't feel like bringing a child into this world was responsible of me. There's a median in the middle of the road on 40th and West Street in Oakland, and just sitting on that median and feeling like I could just jump out and like roll under one of these cars right now. Around that same time period, unfortunately, I had a friend who did actually pass after receiving news that he had two children on the way, actually. And I remember like that really like helped me grab a hold of reality, you know, and seeing that it's bigger than me. Where no matter what condition I'm in, it's better to be there for the child than to not be. And I definitely think it speaks to like my lack of father, me not having a father around, you know, and me saying ultimately, like, even though my dad is full of shit, I wish he were around, you know?
This feeling deep within Penn to break his generational cycle of the absent Black dad eventually overshadowed any feelings of trepidation about his upcoming role as a father. And so he decided to approach this situation as any good journalist would, with a boatload of research. He says he started talking to fathers, Black fathers, lots of them, asking about their experiences, their pitfalls, what was on their minds and their hearts. He even started reading zines like Rad Dads, watching some Ricky Lake, and he started to journal. Eventually, some of what he was finding and learning made its way into his reporting and only furthered his deep dive.
The project that helped me get a lot of followers, people paying attention to my work, was this thing called OG Told Me, where I was interviewing elder Black men, asking them for tidbits of wisdom. And it was somewhat based on how we grew up, we being a group of my friends and I in East Oakland, eight of us or so, no one had fathers in the house. All of us would subconsciously reach out to Black men in the community and look for wisdom or just acknowledgement from the dude who had the, you know, the 67 Cougar or the dude who was driving a bus. And then I have a daughter and I look around my family and I see that, oh, not only did my sister grow up without her father, my niece grew up without her father, my mother's father died when my mother was 10. There's generations of women not having a male figure in their life. It shifted. It shifted with like a paternal presence just kind of shifted in my mind.
Took a lot just to get here.
Last night in Sacramento, there's a Benny the Butcher show. I want to go. You know, he's like one of my favorite rappers right now. But I'm like, I could see if her mom could watch her or I could just be dad. We stayed at home. We made tacos. She comes in the bathroom and she like puts on a backwards hat and she's like goofing around. I'm like, I love this kid, man. She's freaking hilarious, man. My purpose is being served here. I'm very clear on my purpose. And be it a rap concert or a birthday party, whatever, all that can miss me. I'm cool. I'm in the bathroom goofing around with my kid, rapping like it's the 90s while we brush our teeth, you know?
You stayed, but did you ever feel like there was a day where you might want to leave?
Yeah. I currently live in Sacramento. This is a move that came about by way of her mother's decision to relocate.
I'm going to jump in here and say that if you're a Californian listening to this episode, you already know this. But if not, I'm going to need you to understand that California is huge. So this part right here.
I currently live in Sacramento.
This means that Mr. Oakland himself had to wrestle with making a 70-mile move to be near Surrey. Like a whole life shift. Because 70 miles isn't exactly a pick you up after school for a burger kind of distance.
My thought of maybe not even coming to Sacramento to be close to her and her mom. And thinking that I could stay in Oakland and be the every other weekend dad, you know? And again, it was through reaching out to other parents, other single parents, other single black male parents, other single black male parents who work in journalism and asking them about their experience. You know, like I want to get as close to my story as possible so that I can see how it plays out. You know what I'm saying? Like, let me get a glimpse of the future. And I realized that's not what I wanted. I wanted to be there to know like everything. I want to know what scratch she has on her leg, what her shoe size is, what her toenails are painted, all that stuff, you know? So yeah, that choosing to move was my choosing to stay.
So, Mr. Oakland left Oakland, the city he loves, wild. He settled into Sacramento and travels to San Francisco when necessary to work at KQED. Because of this move, he gets to be a 50-50 parent, 1 week on, 1 week off. Turns out that move to Sacramento, 70 miles away from where he wanted to be, was the right move. Penn was about to learn there was even more on the table to grapple with as a parent. And another big shift was lurking right around the corner.
It was coming up on her third birthday, 2019. And I had just landed the podcast with KQED, the Right Knowledge podcast, you know, which was about reporting on Oakland. And I had to make this decision to leave, to move to Sacramento. And I did it. And I'm so glad I did because we all know what happens in 2020. And I'm not running around the streets interviewing anybody at that point, you know? And so being in Sacramento, 70 miles away, like ends up being the best move that I could have made. I fall in love with being a parent, not only because of like the proximity, but also because now I have the ability to be her teacher. And I'm drawing up curriculum during, you know, while, you know, I'm pre-K curriculum for this kid. And yeah, we just hit it off.
The mere act of Penn embracing his present and manifesting his future as a parent, it did shine a bright light on the tough things he had yet to face and reckon with, like his past.
I essentially tracked my father down when I was 24 or so. Like I knew who he was, but didn't talk to him much growing up. Saw him maybe when I was 10. But when he was 24, I found him. He was incarcerated in Alabama. I go on this cross-country journey where I like fly to Chicago, drive to Alabama. I meet him in a prison. We talk, just keep talking about like what happened. Why wasn't he there? Those things. And one of the more profound things that he said to me was that straight up, like he chose crack cocaine over being around me and my sister. And it was this addiction. And it wasn't necessarily just that addiction, but like him running toward that addiction out of a need for love. That addiction or even sometimes even selling drugs, but also using and choosing that over family. I thought about that a lot with like, what am I addicted to? You know, what are the things that I run toward because I want love? The things that I run toward because I want love. It's gonna sound odd, but it's like, Oakland is like my addiction. You know, like the community is like my addiction. I run toward the community because that's my form. They love me, you know, and I love them. And so if I'm sacrificing that, quote unquote, sacrificing that or sacrificing being there for every event because I'm at a ballet recital in Sacramento, then I have no problem with that. And knowing that, like, I'm big on community, you know, like I said, Oakland, everything, right? But you can't preach community without being there for family. Like, family is the first community. How hypocritical are you?
When we come back, we'll hear from a veteran who is no stranger to war. He served in the U.S. Army and has just ended a battle of another kind, on the home front.
3 years of some of the worst stuff imaginable.
That's right after this.
Please put your hands together for the very funny Marlon Fisher, everybody.
His nickname is the Big Fish, a fitting name that captures his standout personality with his larger-than-life stories of worldly experience.
But yeah, I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go back to Brooklyn. And my friend was like, no, check out Vermont. So I did. I looked at websites and I saw beautiful Green Mountains, Lake Champlain, Farm-A-Table-This.
Marlon Fisher is a man I met shortly after I moved to Vermont in 2015. He was part of the growing comedy scene in Burlington before there was a comedy club, performing in restaurants and bars, and wherever else they could get stage time, if there even was a stage. With a microphone in his hands, Marlon can seem fearless. He tells deeply personal stories from his unique life, tales of being in the army and serving our country in Germany and Afghanistan. He takes risks by making fun of the audience, making light of stereotypes and uncomfortable truths.
But I didn't move here for any of those reasons. I moved here because I love white women. What's your name?
He's vulnerable on stage. Pulling from life experiences, sharing stories from moments as special as his own wedding.
And we paid a bunch of money for a photographer, and I had this great, like, fucking white suit with an orange paisley tie and saddle tan boots. And I remember we got our wedding photos, boom, 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 and they came back. It was her in this awesome, nice, beautiful dress next to a suit and teeth.
I've only ever seen Marlon as the Big Fish. Bright, beaming, confident. But once in 2021, I saw a glimpse into a darkness that Marlon was dealing with, a part of his truth that was interfering with his, what I believe to be, unyielding composure and unwavering positivity.
You know, sometimes, like, one thing I like about kids, as Vermont too, is like a lot of parents are really progressive. They're trying to teach their kids about all the cultures, you know, like, these people are from Asia, these people are from Africa, blah, blah, blah. One thing I like about kids.
It was bizarre to see Marlon fumble through his first jokes. What's going on? Marlon doesn't bomb. The situation escalated awkwardly and quickly after he declared he wasn't in the right mindset to perform and fled the stage. I was unsure if this was a new bit, but when the host came out to continue the show, I realized it wasn't. There was something else going on.
I just went through a highly contentious divorce, 3 years of some of the worst stuff imaginable.
Marlon's divorce was a painful one that involved more than just him. He has 2 kids under the age of 10, and at the time, he was deeply worried about what the future may hold. To say Marlon prioritizes fatherhood is an understatement. In fact, in the hierarchy of Marlon's accolades and titles, before being a veteran, before being a storyteller, the most important title for Marlon is being a father.
Like today, I took my kids swimming, or we're in the pool, you know, we're just diving around and splashing and doing all the things, and, you know, my son pops in the water and goes, Daddy, I love you. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's just, we're just having fun. And so that feels good.
For Marlon, being actively present in his children's lives was something he was determined to do, as that was not the case for his upbringing.
You know, growing up, there was my mom and my brother. That was it. We were just a family unit of 3 with no male influence. You know, when my first son was born, obviously, you know, I was really involved in that process. And
And that meant a lot. It meant a lot because it's something that my father had never done.
The crumbling of Marlon's chosen family, the one he built on purpose with his wife and his two sons, crushed him. And being crushed, well, that was just the beginning.
But that divorce turned really nasty, especially for me as a black man here. I've had more interactions with the police in my life in the last 3 years than I've had in my entire life prior to that.
Unfortunately, there's a long list of black men who've been hassled, convicted, or even killed over crimes they didn't commit. From Emmett Till to Ronnie Long, a man who was just released after 44 years in prison, it's in the back of most black men's minds, whether we'd like to admit it or not. At 6'2", having a sizable stature, Marlon is aware how he can stand out in a predominantly white state like Vermont. And with the history of police interactions escalating for people of color, it's a fearful thing to deal with the cops. One of the latest incidents left Marlon frustrated and befuddled.
A black officer knocked on my door this morning to do a welfare check. What I'm like, this is insane. You know, this is the process, blah, blah, blah. But it's a black officer. And I noticed that he has a wedding band on. And he's got to be, as an officer, they have to be as neutral as possible. And I get it. Like, that's their job. But when you're a black officer in Vermont, I said to this guy, if you were to take your uniform off, you have to understand that as a black man, can you understand how this is impacting my life? And that officer responded by saying, a black officer responded by saying, I don't see color.
Yeah.
It's a lot for me to be like, what? You don't see color, bro? You don't like, bro.
All black fathers leave their kids. That's the stereotype we are demystifying today. And Marlon does this. He is the stereo anti-type. He stayed, but after one hell of a fight. And not everyone even knew this fight was happening in these nuanced ways. Perhaps to those on the outside looking in, Marlon could have been just another black deadbeat dad. But he knew. He always knew the sacredness of fatherhood, the gifts that are his children, and the responsibility of bucking this stereotype and being the present black dad, the dad he never had.
I stay because it's just what you have to do, which is just what I have to do. And my kids need me. They need me. Just like I needed somebody. I'm really proud. I'm proud. As a dad, these things can be really hard. But as a black dad, it can be really hard. So as a black father, what's important for me is that my kids have integrity, and then just my presence alone goes a long way.
Pendarvis Harshaw, Marlon Fisher, and my colleague, Bryant Denton. Thank you so much for sharing your journeys as fathers and sons with us here on the show. And thank you so much for listening to Homegoings. It has been a pleasure being here with you. I split the mix and reporting of this episode with Bryant with help from our associate producer, James Stewart. I also composed our theme music, other music by Blue Dot Sessions. Saeed T. John Thomas Jr. edits the show, and we also got a little help from Jane Lindholm, Corey Doxer, and Liam Elder Connors. Elodie Reed teamed up with Zoe McDonald and Laura Nakasaka to create one rad artistic vision for all the portraits in this series on the stereo anti-types. For this episode, Penn, Marlon, and Zuri are front and center, being all cute and family-like and stuff. You should check it out, along with the rest of the stunning artwork we are lucky to have here on Homegoings. You can see them at homegoings.co. While you're there, you can sign up for our bi-weekly newsletter and give us a follow on Instagram at @WeAreHomegoings. See you next week. That's right, we'll be dropping these weekly for a bit for our next stereo anti-type with a big black formerly incarcerated man named Chris Brown, whose life pivot surprised even him. If you have thoughts, reflections, or asks of me as your host about who we should talk to or what we should explore next on the show, write to me at hey@homegoings.co. As always, you are welcome here.